Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, I was born to coal miner's daughter.
Good morning. It's just a few seconds before 11 o'clock here at KBOO Portland. Stay tuned because the bike show's coming up. Tori and April are here to bring you news of bicycling here in Portland and with three guests from beyond Portland, and we look forward to that. Thanks for tuning into KBOO today. Good morning. Welcome to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM, the first Wednesday of each month, streaming live also on KBOO, kboo.com. I'm joined by my co-host, Gracie's Wrench owner, Tori Bortman. Hi, Tori.
Hi, April. Good morning.
In the first segment of the show, we're going to talk about autonomous vehicles, both cars and, surprisingly, autonomous bikes. We'll speak with Dr. Tyler Folsom, an ardent designer and proponent of self-driving bikes, and currently he's professor in computing and software systems at the University of Washington at Bethel. We'll also speak with Ken McLeod. He's a legal specialist at the League of American Bicyclists, and he'll talk about the League's position regarding autonomous vehicles. And finally, for a special treat, we'll ask author Anne Hall a little bit about her new book, Muscle on Wheels. Before we connect with Dr. Tyler Folsom, though, Tori's here to bring us a few news items curated by our other co-host, Alon Robb.
So, a few news items from the world of cycling. Julie-Ann Jentner, New Zealand's Minister for Women and Associate Minister for Transport, as well as Health, gave birth to a boy after riding her bicycle to the hospital for medical inducement. My partner and I cycled because there wasn't enough room in the car for the sport crew, but it also put me in the best possible mood, said the 38-year-old Green Party member. Jenter, 38, is a transportation planner and a cycling advocate. Decades after the interstate highway system eliminated Route 66, the 2,400-mile road from Chicago to Santa Monica that served as a main migration path to the west is coming back to life as a road for cyclists. The first section in Missouri and Kansas was just inaugurated. Cyclists can travel on rural two-lane highways, and much more of the route parallels Interstate 44, which replaced Route 66. In an announcement about two events organized by the Portland group Bike to Groceries, held on September 22nd and 29th at the New Seasons Markets in Concordia and Williams, respectively. We will have advocates and all things bicycles at the storefront. Get a new white bucket pannier, talk to people who are interested in biking but are hesitant, get free maps, goodies, and celebrate how many things you can pack into your panniers. Celebrate bike to eat to work to bike, announces the group. The project started in summer 2017 and aims to reduce automobile use, starting with the fact that over half of our car trips are 3 miles or less, and that most trips to grocery stores involve buying 10 items or less. It also wants to address the growing levels of inactivity and obesity. For more information, contact AJ Zelda at ajz@zelda.com. For all intents and purposes, I should note that I will be tabling there as part of Gracie's Wrench at the Concordia one on the 22nd. So I will look forward to seeing any of our listeners who show up. April, back to you.
Great. Thanks for that. And we'll put information on our Facebook page about that event so that you can follow up if you need more info. Okay. So as Peter Hawley noted in an article on the Washington Post last week, one of the biggest obstacles to adoption of autonomous vehicles is getting people, passengers, pedestrians, scooterers, and bicyclists to trust their competence. A majority of Americans, about 60%, are uneasy, worried about how safe it will be to cross the road when autonomous vehicles debut. In the meantime, those that are working on autonomy in vehicles know that a lot of trial and error is necessary for perfecting the systems. However, since the death of a cyclist killed by an autonomous Uber car, in spite of the fact that a real person was observing behind the wheel, many bicyclists have been filled with worry. It's well known that cyclists and pedestrians are not always predictable, making it hard for a foolproof system to be able to react to every eventuality on the road and on the streets. On the other hand, safety is touted as one of the main reasons to pursue autonomy in vehicles in the first place. Technology companies and a handful of car makers are really fully behind this idea, probably for business reasons, but I thought it would be interesting to speak with our first guest, Dr. Tyler Folsom. Tyler is passionate about self-driving autonomous bicycles. Good morning, Dr. Folsom, and welcome to the show.
Hello, glad to be here.
Great, glad to have you. So I thought I'm going to go to my first questions because I'd like to hear a little bit about what you do and then what intrigues you about the idea of autonomous bicycles. It would be great to hear what set of circumstances kind of brought you to this niche. And if you could, as you're speaking, paint a little bit of a picture for us of exactly what your vision of a self-driving bicycle would be.
Okay, that's a long question. It's kind of where do you want me to start? I've been biking all my life. I'm a hardcore biker, and I'm trying to get other people out of their cars onto bikes.
Yes.
We've got a certain number of people who are going to bike regardless of the hills or darkness or weather, and a lot of other people who won't. And
right.
I'm trying to target that audience.
So okay.
Back to your question, it's what got me into this field. Well, I've always been biking. I was teaching in 2004 when I had a medical problem that forced me to cancel classes for the semester. And I got a call to participate in the Darcy Grand Challenge race, so I went into that. That was Defense Department basically invented autonomous vehicles in 2004 to 2007 with a series of races, first across the Mojave Desert, like a 130-mile race to get a automated vehicle across that. I participated in the second race, and I participated in the third race, which was the Urban Challenge to do things in traffic. The third race was won by Sebastian Thrun at Stanford University. Google then hired him, and he's basically produced the Waymo self-driving car for Google and gone other directions. So that's kind of the.
So were the vehicles you were designing that race, were those bicycles or were those automobile more type?
We had a Jeep Cherokee at the University of British Columbia. So for the second race, we were using a Kawasaki all-terrain vehicle, which is four wheels and gasoline powered. It doesn't really qualify as a bicycle, but it's a little smaller than a car. But after the third race, the group at British Columbia decided to form a corporation, and we were trying to get the autonomous vehicle technology on the market in 2007.
Wow.
And my idea was, since this is an unproven technology, let's do it in something that's not quite as scary as a 4,000-pound vehicle traveling along 60 miles an hour. Let's go with a bicycle-type vehicle traveling at, say, 15 miles an hour and get the technology working and then take it to something where you need to be a little more sure that it's working.
Okay. So maybe you should now hop forward and tell us about the project that you're working on now, and that gives us a little better picture of what your vision is for a self-driving bicycle.
Sure. What I'm doing now is I've now at the University of Washington on the Bothell campus. I teach computer science, electrical engineering, embedded systems there, and my research project is a self-driving tricycle. We have two cat trikes, which is a recumbent tricycle. It's a tadpole trike, two wheels in front, one in the back. And I have automated them. I've taken off the pedals, the chain, the handlebars, and the brake levers, and I've replaced them all with computers that control the steering, the brakes, and the, it's basically a hub motor to make it into an electric bike. So it's all controlled by computer. The operator can control it by joystick, or it can go into purely autonomous mode with the computers calling all the shots.
Okay, so there is some, there's still a little bit of override for the driver.
Yes, well, the way it's designed is that I want this to be part of a transportation system where you have a computer that can control exactly what the vehicle is doing. So you don't want the driver to be able to screw things up by slamming on the brakes at the wrong time because he's scared that he's too close to the vehicle in front of him. So the driver can request to stop a turn or get out of automated mode, but then the computer will not do that until it's safe to do so.
Okay.
That's the idea.
Oh, okay. Excellent. That's interesting.
So I'm wondering then, would it be that your bike, your autonomous bicycle, shows up for you when you want it to? Is that part of it, or is it more that the programming happens? Yes, it shows up.
Yeah, that would be eventually, that was something that would happen. There's basically a number of ways to face them, but the vision is that basically you get a Uber-type application, you ask for your cell phone to ride, the wheels come up to you, you hop in, you go where you're going, and then you hop out.
Okay, and you pre-program where you're going through that application as well? Is that part of the design?
That would be the division, yeah.
Okay, so that sounds so scary to me. So I'm wondering...
But it does to me too, but also awesome.
Yes, right.
I'm like, I'm not sure... It's a little bit how I feel about the new scooters everywhere, that I never rode a scooter, so I feel a little weird about it. But then I see people on them. I see people using them in a really great way, and it's getting more people out of their cars. So,
right.
Yeah. I love this, though.
Oh, good.
I love the idea of being able to call a bike to me.
Okay. Well, so car manufacturers are seeming to believe in this idea of self-driving cars and the end of car ownership, and that it's going to be really incredibly alluring to all of us. And I wonder if you think that's true, but also maybe a little part of that question is, for a self-driving bike, do you think it's going to be the same smaller universe of cyclists that it is with now, that, you know, not, yeah, how does it expand that universe?
Well, the whole idea, the whole concept is to expand the universe. I'm trying to we're looking at a transportation revolution in two directions. One is the direction of automated driving replacing manual driving. The other direction is electric replacing gasoline. So we've got this double revolution going on, and I want to, while we've got all this churn happening, to insert bicycles in there and replace cars. So back to your original question, can you restate that?
Yeah.
Okay. Why is this? Why do car manufacturers think this would be alluring?
Yeah.
I think that's basically self-fulfilling. If a car manufacturer decide they want to market this, then they've got the bucks to convince people that they want to go this direction, and whether they want to market that depends on whether they're going to make money at it.
Exactly.
So if there are some projections that this is a profitable way to go, I haven't taken hard look at those numbers, but if that happens, if they can make money off it, they will market it and make it happen. The downside on that is that the car companies have a whole lot more money to market than the bicycle companies, and there's not going to be much of a constituency pushing to get rid of the cars with bikes, unless if we can get some of the big companies to go with the bike option. And that's a possibility. You've got companies like Uber and Lyft are getting into bike share. So
yeah, and
who knows?
And scooter share now too. I mean, it's
right.
All.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that's coming up, I wonder about part of your vision that comes up with the scooters, at least in Portland, is that by the end of the day, you have a hard time finding one that there are enough that are still charged. How would the charging? Do you imagine the charging working?
That's difficult. My solution is that I would design a transportation system so that if you've got a self-driving bike, it would take itself to a refueling station, and you'd have a robot that would swap out the battery.
Right.
And then you've got a fresh battery on the vehicle. It takes it to wherever it's going for its next ride. And the nice thing about that is you wind up with a bank of discharged batteries that need to get charged, and it doesn't particularly matter when. So whenever you've got the sun shining or the wind blowing, you charge the batteries, which means you've got transportation from renewable energy.
Right, which is great. Okay, so I think one of the things, you know, when I say, oh, that sounds scary to me to think about a self-driving bicycle, it seems, though, that the more that we all know about these autonomous vehicles, the easier acceptance that we'll have of them. And so I'd like you to talk for a little while about how autonomous is going to be sort of better than human-driven and how long that might take.
Well, in some cases, autonomous is already better than human. I watched a video a few years back about a 100-car pileup on the freeway in snow. There are autonomous snowplows that can operate in zero visibility. In most circumstances, there are cases where humans are considerably better than robots. One problem we have is that these robots don't drive like humans, and we're expecting our drivers to act like humans. If you look at the trend in computing, presently supercomputers are getting darn close to having the computational power of the human brain.
Wow.
And you can probably expect that to hit your desktop by about 2030, where you're
Wow.
going to have the power of the human brain. And parallel to that, you've
The civil authorities have issued a required monthly test for Clark W.A., Clackamas O.R., Columbia O.R., Washington O.R., and Monoma O.R., beginning at 10:15 a.m. and ending at 12:15 p.m. This is a coordinated monthly test of the emergency alert system through broadcast stations in the greater Portland/Vancouver area, including Clackamas, Columbia, Monoma, and Washington counties in Oregon, and Clark County in Washington. With the cooperation of public safety, broadcasters, and cable operators, this system informs you of events that pose an immediate threat to your life, health, or property. If this had been an actual emergency, official information would have followed the alert tone. This test was originated by Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency in Vancouver, Washington. This concludes this test message.
Okay, so you were just saying that in 2030 that we'd have that human brain and...
That computers would be able to actually do the same work as a human brain, which is kind of insane. We kind of left off there in you answering the question of, like, what does the timeline look like for autonomous vehicles?
So for a lot of the stuff, it's basically pretty much there today or in a couple of years, you can have major pieces of automation happening. The question you're asking about is for total automation. That's what Society of Automotive Engineers calls level 5, where it's autonomous all the time in all circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
We're not close to being able there yet. We are getting close today to being able to do level 4, which is autonomous in certain circumstances, such as driving on the freeway or self-parking vehicles. So that's pretty much feasible with today's technology.
Okay.
The really challenging thing is getting vehicles that can operate in traffic with all the crazy things that happen in traffic.
Right.
And on the one hand, human drivers are pretty bad. They kill about 40,000 people a year in the U.S. with a disproportionate number of those deaths being pedestrians and bicyclists and motorcyclists. But on the other hand, humans are able to drive about 1,000,000 miles between fatal accidents. And if you think of your computer system, your electronics, your phone, you know, good luck on getting it to last for 10 or 20 years without a reboot. So getting actually that level of reliability is problematic.
Okay. Well, so our time is winding down, but I did want to say that I did want to let our listeners know about your Elcano project. And so where should they get more information about that Elcano project if they're interested in getting a little bit more clued in?
Yeah. So our website is elconoproject.org. It's named for Juan Sebastian O'Connell, the first person to sail around the world, which was not Magellan, by the way. So if you go to that and look at the wiki has documentation on the open source program we have, and then there's a page of links that takes them to a lot of other interesting places.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Tyler Folsom, for being on our show, and good luck with the Elcano project in the future.
Okay, good luck with making bikes everywhere.
Thank you.
If you'd like more information about Dr. Folsom's project, we will have some links up on our Facebook page.
So you are listening to the KBOO Bike Show on 90.7 FM and through live streaming on kboo.fm. We've just been speaking with Tyler Folsom about autonomous bicycles, and now we're going to switch tracks just a little bit and have a conversation with Ken McLeod. He's the legal specialist at the League of American Bicyclists, and for at least the past 4 years, the League has followed the advance of autonomy and kept tabs on the feelings of cyclists. So welcome to the show, Ken McLeod.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great. So I wanted to first read the League's position on autonomy. The League of American Bicyclists supports the development and deployment of automated vehicles. The League believes that automated vehicles will eventually improve the safety of people who bike and walk and provide opportunities for communities to create better places to bike and walk as vehicles become more law-abiding and predictable. Wow, can't wait for that day. Automated vehicles, that wasn't the League, that was me. Automated vehicles cannot be distracted, should not be able to speed or otherwise violate traffic laws, and should be able to detect, recognize, and react to bicyclists and pedestrians as well as human drivers or better. So my question is, how long is eventually?
I think it's a great question. I think there's really three things that people should be watching to kind of figure out what eventually is. The first thing is the thing that'll happen first, which is when a manufacturer will, you know, make automated vehicles publicly available. We're starting to see trials with Waymo, there's a business called Drive.ai in Texas that's doing trials on public streets, but those are still trials, not massively available vehicles. The second thing to kind of watch is just how quickly are these vehicles adopted. There's a 2017 study by the RAND Corporation that kind of lets you play around with adoption curves, but they were all within 20 to 50 years. And then the third thing about eventually, in terms of things being eventually safer, communities being eventually better, because we don't have to base our communities around cars as much as we can make them about people. Mm. That'll really depend on if we have kind of adaptive changes for automated vehicles rather than people in reaction to their deployment. So if automated vehicles are allowed to speed, that would be something that would affect when we are eventually safer.
Okay.
Right, what the limits of the law will be on the vehicles. Well, back in 2014, the League did a survey from your 357 responses. You could deduce that just over 40% of respondents believed automated cars could improve safety. 14% thought autonomy would reduce safety, and the rest didn't feel like they had enough information. Do you think those numbers have shifted much in the last 4 years?
My gut says no, but there was a really interesting survey published by AAA under the headline American Trust in Autonomous Vehicles Slipped. And that survey, which was published in 2018, said that 63% of U.S. drivers would feel less safe sharing the road with fully self-driving cars while walking or riding a bike. So So that seems to say that there's been a shift, or our sample is different than AAA's sample.
Interesting. So they were, just so I get that right, they said less people who are cyclists or pedestrians would feel safe with autonomous vehicles.
Yeah, 63%.
Wow.
They'd feel less safe sharing the road with autonomous vehicles.
Wow.
That's interesting. So people have learned more, and they feel even, and yeah, that's super interesting. But we've also had a major accident with an autonomous vehicle in the meantime, and that definitely is going to change that perspective. So,
yeah, I feel
definitely.
I feel strongly that people need to have a lot more information than they're even getting now in the mainstream way. I don't know. It's one of the most prominent concerns, it seems, was of those that were surveyed by the league in 2014 was the inability of cyclists to communicate with the car. So you can't wait for that sort of eye communication when you're stopped in an intersection, as well as the possible failure of the technology, which we have seen there's going to be some failures. But I wonder if personally you've seen the signs that the technology is improving so that cyclists and pedestrians will be more easily recognized by self-driving autonomous cars.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that we need a lot more transparency. I'd love to be getting more information from automakers about how their systems work, how their systems interact with bicyclists and pedestrians, what issues they still have to solve, maybe where they can partner with cities, states, federal government to solve those issues in a collaborative way. It really feels like the industry is worried about kind of the business of automated vehicles right now, and so it doesn't want to be public about any of the possible safety drawbacks or issues that they're facing as they are creating this technology.
Because everybody wants to come out first and the best.
So yeah.
They don't want to, yeah. That's unfortunate.
I think that's definitely unfortunate. I would say that there's been a little bit of progress in terms of the communication, like that eye contact thing.
Mm-hmm.
Drive.ai, which is operating in a couple cities in Texas, has electronic signboards on the outside of its vehicles that'll say that it sees you, it's yielding to you.
Wow.
I've only seen them in English. There's this whole issue of how you make those interactions universal in a way.
Like
that
a crosswalk is kind of universal.
Right.
Go ahead and walk. I see you. You know, yeah, that's such an interesting part of the technology that it hadn't occurred to me that you could fix that.
Yeah, I actually saw an automated vehicle, and I believe it's being tested here in Portland because Jaguar has a big facility over on the other side of the river where they're doing this kind of thing. And that small autonomous vehicle had eyes. It had big eyes where above where you would think the headlights would be, and those eyes could move to show.
Creepy and awesome.
Yeah, wow. Creepy and awesome at the same time, exactly. So another key issue for those surveyed was the idea that these autonomous vehicles, and of course you probably didn't ask about autonomous bicycles, but that they might slow down or undermine efforts to promote biking and walking. What do you feel about that? Has that been a concern of the league?
In the short term, I would say no. I think we're really focused on, watching legislation around the vehicles and making sure that safety is the number one priority as they develop these vehicles and create a regulatory structure for automated vehicles. Certainly when I go to transportation conferences, I'm always on the lookout for an engineer proposing a solution to something that I don't think needs a solution. So, I often see a proposal for an intersection that doesn't have any signals and has cars kind of weaving through in a mesh. And that just seems impassable as a bicyclist or pedestrian. So still worried about that kind of thing that'll undermine biking and walking, but it's not a short-term concern.
Okay.
Yeah, I can see... I just think we're going through an interesting moment in Portland with the scooters being dropped in, and that's it's disruptive, I feel like, but in a good way. There's a lot of people who are not happy about them and a little bit, well, more than a little bit grumpy about them. I would put it at grumpy because they're not really that
incensed.
Yeah, they're just like, but the interesting thing to me is that it's putting a lot of people on the street who would never ride a bicycle.
Right.
And interacting with vehicles who would never ride a bicycle and who maybe drive regularly. And so I would never, if somebody said to me 10 years ago, oh, scooters are coming, I'd be like, yeah, right. But now it seems like, well, scooters are here and they're actually disrupting the system in both good and bad ways.
Exactly. So it's time for us to take a little break, and we'll come back to some more interesting questions on this issue. You're listening to the KBOO Bike Show on 90.7 FM and through live streaming on kboo.fm. So to stay tuned, we'll be right back after this short break. Thanks for being with us today on The Bike Show. We're looking at autonomous vehicles, whether they are bicycles or are interacting with them, whether it's bicycles, autonomous bicycles, or the interaction between bicycles and cars. And right now, we're here with Ken McLeod. He's a legal specialist at the League of American Bicyclists, and we're discussing how the two might peacefully coexist on the road. So it was very interesting to me that was something that the League was talking about, that the necessity of a vision test for autonomous vehicles and what that would look like. I think that would be very interesting for our listeners to hear about.
Yeah. So there's a federal legislation right now called the AV START Act, which would kind of create the first federal national framework for automated vehicles. Right now, there's a lot of state regulation of automated vehicles, and states are responsible for licensing drivers, and in automated vehicles, the driver is a computer. But there's a big push from manufacturers to have uniform legislation, regulation nationwide, so that they can develop nationwide, and they don't have to worry about California having stricter regulations than Arizona, and things like that. So we think it's important that in this initial regulation, we're making sure that these vehicles are going to be safe and that they can detect and respond to all roadway users. So the language we're proposing is really that NHTSA will create a rule that'll specify requirements that automated driving systems are able to detect and respond to all roadway users, including bicyclists and pedestrians, people in wheelchairs, that they can read and interpret roadway signage and highway markings. And we think like that's just a basic thing to ensure safety, make sure that they can operate on our roadways.
So the vision, the quote-unquote vision test means the cars can actually see? Is that kind of what the vision is? Which part is the vision?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's, you know, we're just asking for the legislation to say that NHTSA will create a rule. So there would be a rulemaking process where the automakers and researchers and others that are very, you know, technically involved with this technology will say the best way to accomplish this test. But it would look potentially at the camera systems, LIDAR, radar systems, and then the AI that is processing those images and ensuring the AI knows what it's seeing when it's seeing those images.
So okay. Yeah, because one of the things that I've read about autonomous vehicle, autonomous cars, and motorized larger vehicles, not the bicycles we were talking about earlier, is that cyclists are extremely hard to account for because they are
unpredictable, much more
unpredictable. I think they're predictable.
Yeah.
Because I ride one, so I understand the things that cyclists might come up with. But in the scale of, you know, if I see glass in the road, I might leave my position in the lane that I'm in. But a car doesn't see that as being predictable because they can't see that glass because they're too far away or too far up. But that bicyclists are particularly hard for cars to quote unquote see, to have that vision. So do you think that that's going to be one of the hardest things for the manufacturers to work on?
I mean, certainly what we're hearing is that bicycles are harder than other things for them to see and detect and respond to. You know, I think pedestrians present similar issues in that, you know, pedestrians can really easily move in any direction at any time. Kind of, there's also things like the ball that bounces into a street, mm-hmm. and whether or not it follows that. I think there's a lot of tough issues that these vehicles have to face. I'm not sure that our vision tests through a rulemaking process would get at all of those, mm-hmm. But it would get at the basics of whether, you know, under what conditions can they see a bicyclist? Is it 100 feet away, 200 feet away? Do they accurately read speed limit signs every time that they pass them so they know what speed limit to go? We've seen presentations by machine learning researchers who say with a little bit of duct tape, you can easily kind of hack the vision of automated vehicles so they can't read stop signs, speed limit signs, things like that. So with a vision test, we would have, you know, a rule that establishes a standard for what the vehicles can see and kind of allows us to know how they perform on those tests.
Great.
And if they're going to be hacked or thrown off in certain ways.
So one thing that I found interesting in researching this show was that that the experience that's happening right now in Pittsburgh, and I hadn't read all that much about that, so I don't think it's on a lot of people's radars, but it seems that the more that cyclists and pedestrians interact with autonomous vehicles, the more they discover that these cars are not as distracted or aggressive as we are as human drivers. And that's a big plus. That was one thing that helped me kind of get over a little bit the hump of like, oh, I don't want autonomous cars out on the road. I realized that there, I kind of physically felt that there could be advantages. But one thing that we've touched on a little bit is that the manufacturers and people who are creating these systems need to be more transparent. And so I want to see if you think that there are any ways that cyclists and members of the league can push these Ubers and Waymos of the world to be more proactive and transparent, knowing that they're in a competitive environment and, like mm-hmm. Tori said, they want to be first and best.
Yeah, well, in Pittsburgh, the bike advocates at Bike PGH kind of worked with Uber and got Uber to put a URL on on their test cars so that bicyclists could report their interactions with them. So that was a nice proactive thing that they could do. And I think generally we need to be pushing these companies that are working in our communities. I've heard some researchers say that this is basically a big experiment that they didn't ask us to participate in. We need to be pushing them to reveal some of the results of what they're doing, be more transparent with how good their systems are and what issues they still are working on, so that we can learn from that and make sure that we're going into this technology with full information.
Okay. Did you have a question, Tori?
I did. I had a caller called in and kind of wanted to address the idea of autonomous vehicles, whether they be autonomous bicycles or autonomous cars, being vulnerable because of the technology to being taken over by rogue you know, whether that be the government or, you know, China coming in or whomever, Russia, and hacking or doing things like that. And is it more important for the technology to come along, or is it more important for us to stay protected from the technology in some ways?
I haven't paid a lot of attention to cybersecurity concerns. I know that the AV Start Act addresses some cybersecurity concerns. It's a big issue that people are aware of as they're creating this legislation. My view would be that we need to put safety first and shouldn't roll out technology just for technology's sake. You know, having a big cybersecurity risk, having potentially hacked vehicles would be one of those kind of adaptive challenges that might make that eventually further and further off if we roll out these vehicles, but they are subject to hacking or other malicious use and actually make our roadways less safe.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Ken McLeod, for agreeing to be on the show. And if you, our listeners, want to know more about the League's stance on autonomous vehicles, you can find links on our Facebook page to the sections of the League website that talks about that. So thanks a lot, Ken, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and thanks for featuring this issue.
Great. So you're listening to KBOO, The Bike Show, at 90.7 FM, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, and streaming live on the web at kboo.fm. So our final guest today is going to be Anne Hall. She's Professor Emerita at the University of Alberta. And Anne's new book, just released a few days ago, is called Muscle on Wheels, Louise Armando and the High Wheel Racers of 19th Century America. As I'm writing a historical novel right now about Louise's quest to be a recognized bicycle racer back in the 1880s, I'm really well acquainted with Anne's scholarship and her deep knowledge and historical sleuthing that she's done on Louise's life. So thanks so much for joining us, Anne.
You're most welcome.
So I'd like to start with letting our listeners know if you could tell us how you originally got interested in Louise's life and the other high wheel racers of the early era of bicycling.
Sure. I've been researching the history of women's sport in Canada for a very, very long time. And I've written several books on the subject. And I came across Louise Armando, and I realized that she was probably among Canada's very first professional athletes, male or female. And so I wanted to gain more information about her, and I started researching her. Now, I'm a sport historian, but I'm not necessarily a bicycle historian. I think I've become a bit of a bicycle historian in this project, but I certainly wasn't when I started. And as I learned more and more about cycling history, I realized that cycling historians had totally ignored Louise and the other women racers of that high wheel era. So the project became much, much more and much larger and more complicated than I'd ever imagined, from what I thought would be a kind of a simple biography of Louise to something that was much, much bigger. It was a story of a whole era. So that's where it all began.
So at that,
I would say about 5 or 6 years ago.
Right. And that's a bit about what fascinated me when I started looking at bicycle history for a book that I wrote back in 2012. And it's still, I still have the same question, so I'm going to pose it to you. Why do you think that this era and a lot of the strides that women started to make really early on in the bicycle era, in their athleticism, in their better outfits, definitely, shedding some of the many pounds of underwear, and just the idea of freedom that bicycling gives, why was that so completely like left out of the narrative, and that we always, in the bicycle history, what we see mostly is that women didn't, that's the narrative that's not quite true, that women didn't ride until the safety bike was created in the early 90s. Why do you think that this has happened?
Well, I think there are two main reasons. I put some of the blame on historians of women's sport, myself included, because I don't think we've done a very good job of ferreting out and documenting working class women's, especially professional sport, in the late Victorian era. And this would include baseball, boxing, wrestling, pedestrianism, or what it then was endurance walking, cycle racing, and so forth. We just simply haven't paid a lot of attention to that era. And the second reason, and probably the more important one, is cycling historians are overwhelmingly male. And they've treated the high wheel era, primarily in the 1880s, as masculine. In other words, the only people who they suggest were riding these high wheel bicycles were athletic young men who rode them in cycling clubs. And in the safety bicycle era, primarily in the 1890s, they've determined as being feminine. And these are the terms that are actually used if you look through the literature. And this is when large number of women began riding the bicycle because it was a safety bicycle. It was more safe than the high wheel. It was easier to ride. It had pneumatic tires, and that's when the cycling craze began. So what this has done is then rendered women's incredible athletic activity, and there was much of it in the high wheel era, totally invisible until now, of course, with I think the advent of my book. And even bicycling historians, women historians of the bicycle, have made this same mistake. They've just parroted what the male cycling historians have written about for years. And so I hope this book changes our perceptions of these two very interesting eras in bicycle history.
Hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that I was fascinated when I've done some of my research is what bicycle racing actually consisted of back in the 1880s. So maybe you'd like to give us a couple minutes about what those bicycle races were.
Because I can't imagine riding a high wheel, let alone racing it, because it doesn't seem very comfortable.
And they were incredible tests of endurance, more so, or as at least as much as these days the Tour de France. So I'd love to hear, Anne, a little bit of what you discovered in your research about those races back in the 1880s.
Yeah. They of course, were only riding the high wheels, and these are some kinds of people, when people read about this, these are some kind sometimes called penny farthings, which was the British term for the high wheel bicycle, or they were called ordinaries. And they were called ordinaries when the safety bicycle came in to distinguish them from the safety bicycle. So you have a period of time when there were both kinds of bicycles being ridden. But anyway, the high wheel racing was a mixture of amateur, professional, and exhibition races. And Louise, who initially only raced against men because there were no other women for her to race, was involved as a professional. In other words, she was in it to make money. So in the early days of this kind of racing, the most popular kind of race was what was called the six-day race. And these had been made very popular in the pedestrian area. And at the same time, these races were brought indoors. So they were brought into armories, stock pavilions, roller skating rinks, exhibition halls, and eventually into Madison Square Garden. And sort of makeshift wooden tracks, what we would call the oval today, were set up in these areas that could contain them. And some of them were quite small, so they meant the turns around the track were really quite tight. So they raced over 6 days because in most areas of the country, it was not possible to race on Sunday. So they would start on Saturday and they would finish up on Monday, and follow up on the Saturday. In the beginning, most of these were 12-hour races. Later on, they became shorter races, but the 12-hour, 72-hour race was the most popular.
Wow.
So races would start at about noon and would race continuously until midnight. Now, they could take breaks when they needed them. They usually had a tent and a trainer or an agent or somebody with them so they could hop off the bike and get massage or get some food or whatever they needed. But they had to be careful because if they were too long on the break, then other racers would get ahead of them. And the object was to accomplish, who could accomplish riding the most miles over that 72 continuous hours? Of course, gambling and betting went on at these venues.
I was going to say, because it's a long race, what was the attraction for the participants? But gambling is always a good, that always helps keep people interested.
That was it. And of course, as these races, these were endurance races. Well, it wasn't until really the end that, you know, when they started to see, well, who's going to win and who is, that you really get the exciting part of the race. But people would come to these, they would attend them, both men and women. I think initially most men attended these. And Louise was an expert at this. In 1883, for example, in Chicago's Battery D Armory, she was racing with two of the top male professionals, Woodside and Morgan, and she won fair and square. She didn't have a handicap in this race. They all started at the same time, and she won by cycling 843 miles in 72 hours.
What?
And this was an American record at the time. So that just gives you a sense of the kind of athlete that we were dealing with when you talk about Louise.
Right, and what I think is interesting is that, I mean, that was kind of the first time that a woman's endurance was tested to that degree, but also that maybe those slight advantages that females might have in endurance events was highlighted because she did so well. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about was that division between exhibition and amateur and professional, which was coming into being at about that time. One of the things that we haven't really discussed is that there was also a lot of voyeurism and gawking. I mean, just at the fact that you could come to one of these races, pay 50 cents to get in, and then see these women in pretty scanty clothing. So that's part of, or I'd like to ask you, to me it seems like that was part of the draw.
Well, it was and it wasn't. You know, for most of this period, April, right up until about 1888, you only have Louise Armendeau, and she's racing primarily against men. And the other racer who comes in this period is a woman by the name of Elsa von Blumen, whose real name was Caroline Kiner. Now, they could not have been more different. For example, Elsa raced primarily only trotting horses, so she was racing outdoors most of the time. She would not countenance any betting or gambling or anywhere she went. She didn't like the smelly, close atmosphere of the indoor arena, and she only once did she agree to race Louise, and they did this outdoors, and she was completely demolished, and they never raced again together for about another 8 years. So Louise was on her own all this time, and she was spectacular, really, because the exhibition races that I talked about, she would travel with her agent Tom Eck, and they traveled. It's amazing where she traveled in the country, to almost all parts of the United States, except in the central western part, which was not developed yet. But she had to go across there to get to San Francisco and race quite extensively in California. Now, these were primarily exhibition races, but my feeling in all of this, that they were coming to watch an athlete. People were astounded at her accomplishments. They were astounded at the way she could race. Mm. Now, when more women came into this, and they came into it because promoters began to realize that women would be a draw. And so you get around the latter part of 1888, in beginning of 1889, you get a group of women who are trained. They'd never raced before, and they're trained to race, and a race takes place in Madison Square Garden. And it's not a highly successful race, but I think that's when you begin to see the more gawking, the more novelty, the more exhibitionist attitude towards the women racing, because it wasn't entirely positive. But out of that group came a group of about five women who were absolutely spectacular, and it was these women who then made the transition to the safety era. And again, they in that safety era, they continued to race and were highly successful. So I don't entirely agree with the argument about them being, you know, part of a voyeurism, part of an exhibitionism. That I never got that real sense. So as I know where Louise was, probably every month of every year between 1879 and her death in 1900. So I just don't get that sense and I tried to write about that in the book a little bit.
Okay. Well, you touched on this really briefly, but what is the perception about bicycling that you would most like to change with readers of your book?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that women have always raced bicycles, and I think this is not clearly understood, even from the early days of the velocipede in the 1860s. And we now have getting a much better insight into that particular period. I'm involved in an interesting a group of other people interested in cycling history, and we're beginning to get some really interesting research coming out of that particular era to find out more and more that women were racing even velocipedes. And I think that, as I pointed out just a minute ago, my book demonstrated that there were about 20 women professional high wheel racers in North America during that high wheel era. And most of these racers had switched to a safety bicycle by the mid-90s, and about, as I said, about 8 former high-wheel racers became successful racers in the safety era. And what's also exciting is another book that has just come out by Roger Gillis, Women on the Move, The Forgotten Era of Women Bicycle Racing. And he takes his story where I left off. I leave off the story about the mid-1890s, 1900 after Louise died, but from about 1895 through to 1905, you get a very, very interesting period of women racing safety bicycles, none of which has been known before, and his book covers all that. So I think between the two of us, we've covered an era that has really not been discussed very, very much at all.
Yeah, that's awesome. We will put some information about that book as well onto our Facebook page. So I know one of the things that you mentioned was that you have become something of a bicycle historian in the long process of researching Louise's life, which I well know it was little bits and little bits to put together the picture of what she actually did and where she ended up. And I'll let people read your book to figure out what happened to her after that race in 1889. But I wondered, and I wanted to kind of wrap up with, were there any insights that you gained from studying Louise that can help women biking today or convert more women to be bicyclists?
Well, I think there are a couple things. Cycling, as you well know, I don't have to tell you people, but it's divided really between the recreational transportation, good roads movement, safer biking in cities, and cycle racing. And I don't think that women need any help with the first of those. I think they're very strong advocates for safer cycling cities. I live in Edmonton in Alberta, Canada. It's the most northern city in Canada and the largest northern city. And we are now starting to get an amazing paths of bicycling paths, and even though, you know, most of the time we're in winter here, but it's all happening, and there are strong women involved with that. Where the racing culture is still a huge issue. Women simply don't have the same opportunities. They're not treated as equals. There's still a great deal of misogyny within the cycle racing culture. And to be effective, I think women cycling advocates, racing cyclists, they need to learn more about their history. They need to learn more about what has happened in the past and bring that forward to whomever, in whatever context it has to be, to push for more opportunities for women to race.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for joining us, Anne, and congratulations on your new book. If our listeners would like to find your book, where can they go?
Usual places, Amazon.
Okay. And we will have the link to that site or to a place to buy the book posted on our Facebook page. So thanks so much for joining us. And again, congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to have been there.
Thanks. So you've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcast from Portland, Oregon, on the first Wednesday of every month. We'll have links to all of our guests' websites on our Facebook page. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at bikeshow.portland/transport.com. I didn't do too well with that, but it will be on our Facebook page. The Bike Show is produced by myself, April Streeter, and Alone Rob, along with our co-host, Tori Bortman. We'd like to thank our in-studio engineer, Tammy, our web host, Chris Smith, and today's guests, as well as our editor, Josh Hetrick. If you have comments, questions, or show ideas, The Bike Show would love to hear from you. You can contact us on Facebook at our Twitter handle at KBOO Bike Show, or email us through the KBOO website. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the world, from the bike world. Until then, make it a great day and keep riding your bike. Until I get home.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KABU is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society's new concert season, which starts September 21st of this year and runs through May of 2019, all staged at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. The Portland Folk Music Society is pleased to present a lineup of national and regional artists, including Molly O'Brien and Rich Moore, the Kathy Kallick Band, the Honey Whiskey Trio, Legends of the Celtic Harp with Patrick Ball, True North, Tish Hinojosa, Pat Donahue, Nina Gerber and Chris Webster, and Dave Stamey. And for the first time, the Portland Folk Music Society is offering season ticket packages at prices below single show rates, either online or at the door. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and look on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 12 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for the KABU News at noon for Wednesday, September 5th, 2018. Progressives are cheering a landslide victory for Ayanna Pressley in the Democratic primary in Massachusetts. Her opponent, incumbent Mike Capuano, is a 20-year veteran of the U.S. Congress. Pressley argued that in the age of Trump, the Massachusetts 7th Congressional District and the nation need bold activist leadership. This follows similar upsets against the Democratic establishment in Florida's gubernatorial primary with Andrew Gillum, and a win